From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. Unholy wars, Afghanistan, America, and international terrorism. We'll talk about the Mujahideen and the CIA and go to Germany, where much of the investigation is centered. Then a debate on the Northern Alliance. Should the U.S. fund this group fighting the Taliban in northern Afghanistan? All that and more coming up on Democracy Now in Exile's War and Peace Report. Welcome to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration yesterday advanced its diplomatic effort to wage war on Osama bin Laden and Afghanistan's Taliban regime, securing a renunciation of the Taliban by Saudi Arabia and Russian consent to use former Soviet air bases for U.S. strikes. The moves come as the Group of Seven, the world's wealthiest nations, agreed to join the United States in freezing alleged terrorist assets. At the White House, President Bush met with the Japanese prime minister, who offered non-military support. But a strong note of caution was sounded by Pakistan, a crucial ally in any campaign, when it warned the United States against trying to install a new government in Kabul. Foreign Minister Abdul Sattar urged the Bush administration to put aside any notion of supporting Afghan opposition groups that are battling to replace the ruling Taliban, which has intimate ties with Pakistan's security services. In a momentous move, the Russian defense minister, Sergei Ivanov, yesterday said the United States could use military facilities in Tajikistan to launch strikes on neighboring Afghanistan if the need arises, marking the first time Russia has publicly approved what would be an unprecedented U.S. military presence in former Soviet Central Asia. Leaders of several Central Asian countries in recent days have publicly offered use of their airspace and military facilities to the United States. Since Ivanov's first statement, Putin has held lengthy consultations with leaders of Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and Kyrgyzstan. Kazakh President Nursultan Nazarbayev said on Monday he was ready to allow U.S. warplanes to launch strikes from Kyrgyzstan's President Askar Aliyev, who said, "We are ready to provide our airspace." But the free Central Asian countries that border Afghanistan have been less forthcoming. Bush met Japanese Prime Minister Koizumi, the latest in a procession of world leaders to make a pilgrimage to the White House in the past 2 weeks. Koizumi said Japan would help politically, diplomatically, and economically, but would not join the fighting. Earlier Tuesday, Bush briefed leaders of Congress on the extent of the U.S. military deployment within striking distance of Afghanistan, telling them not to expect conventional warfare like the Gulf conflict. In related news, the Pentagon has changed the code name of its military buildup to Operation Enduring Freedom. The change was made after the initial name, Operation Infinite Justice, last week ran into objections from some Islamic scholars and Muslim groups in many countries on grounds that only God or Allah could mete out infinite justice, and that the operation's name was a religious insult. U.S. diplomats are pressing the U.N. Security Council to draft a resolution that could pose the threat of international sanctions on any country that does not cooperate in isolating and prosecuting terrorists in its territory. The resolution, of which a first draft is expected within the next 2 weeks, could legally bind countries to halt funding flows to terrorist organizations, prosecute those who give so-called terrorists shelter or support, and more openly share information about so-called terrorist networks and their whereabouts. U.S. officials, including Condoleezza Rice, National Security Advisor, and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, have both said the U.S. will not seek Security Council authorization for military attacks against Afghanistan. The Islamic al-Rashid Trust in Afghanistan is engaged in rebuilding roads, feeding the poor, providing limbs to amputees, and supplying sewing machines to widows so they can eke out a living. Now the group is protesting at being included on President Bush's list of 27 suspected Islamic terrorist groups and individuals whose assets should be frozen. Leaders of Al-Rashid called the allegations against the charity unfounded and unjustified. They said the attempt by the United States to restrict their benevolence exposed America as an opponent of Muslims rather than of terrorists, and said they, quote, reserve the right to legal action. In Kabul, Afghanistan's capital, it's hard to miss the many Al-Rashid signs evident in most parts of the city. The organization has opened dozens of bakeries supplying subsidized bread to the war-ravaged, drought-parched population. Al-Rashid, which is based in Pakistan, and several other Islamic charities have entered Afghanistan in a major way during the last year. The ruling Taliban have found the trend encouraging. Many make little secret of their hopes that Muslims will replace Western relief agencies and the United Nations as the nation's chief benefactors.
The Constitution, a noble piece of paper, with free society, a struggle, but they died in vain. And now democracy is a ragtime on the corner, hoping for some rain. It look like either hoping for some rain. And I see the robins perched in barren treetops. They're watching last-ditch races marching across the floor. But just like the peace signs that vanished in our dreams, never had a chance to grow. Never had a chance to grow. And now it's winter.
Winter in America. Gil Scott-Heron and Brian Jackson, Midnight Band, here on Ground Zero Radio's Democracy Now in Exile, War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 2 weeks after the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, investigators have not yet identified any knowing accomplices in the United States or uncovered a broad support network that assisted the 19 hijackers. This, according to a senior law enforcement official in yesterday's New York Times. The official, who's actively involved in the investigation, said that a key to unraveling the plot might lie not in the United States, but in Germany. A team of agents has been dispatched to pursue leads there. Based on investigators' portraits of the suspected hijackers and their movements before the September 11th attacks, the official said federal agents are investigating whether the plot had its origins in Germany and then branched out to hubs in Newark, Boston, Florida, and Maryland. Now, of course, we don't know if any of this is true. What we just read is according to an unnamed source quoted in the New York Times. That's the problem. So much of what you're going to read in the papers and hear on television is based on unnamed sources. Some of it may turn out to be true. A lot of it probably will not. Well, Germans were shocked to learn that three hijackers had reportedly lived unobtrusively in the city of Hamburg, in one case for at least 8 years. According to the Financial Times, Germany's chief prosecutor is saying that for many months the city has been the base for a cell of Islamic extremists involving the three hijackers, an alleged ringleader who may now have fled to Pakistan, and possibly others. German police are currently investigating financial ties between two of the hijackers and a Syrian businessman who controls a Hamburg bank account belonging to a founder of Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda network. Meanwhile, the group of seven leading industrial nations yesterday pledged to pursue a comprehensive strategy to disrupt so-called terrorist funding around the world. The G7 finance ministers considered a new United Nations resolution that would stiffen sanctions against financial centers that fail to comply with money laundering guidelines and require authorities to report suspicious financial activities. This move comes a day after President Bush froze assets in the U.S. belonging to Osama bin Laden and 26 other people in groups suspected of supporting him. U.S. officials are planning to travel to Gulf capitals later this month to press their investigation directly with banking authorities and financial institutions. We're joined now by John Cooley. He's a U.S. correspondent who has covered North Africa and the Middle East for 40 years and has written the book Unholy Wars, Afghanistan, America, and International Terrorism. Welcome to Democracy Now! in Exile, John Cooley.
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you with us. Your book is possibly the most detailed account of the CIA's backing of the Mujahideen in the 1980s, and we want to get to that in a minute. But first, you're in Munich right now. Can you summarize the investigation that's underway in Germany?
Well, the German local police, particularly in Hamburg, kicked it off almost immediately after the attacks. It was picked up by the German Counterintelligence Service and the BKA, which is the German equivalent of the FBI, the federal German law enforcement agency. And it has spread from Hamburg, where this cell that you mentioned of the hijackers and of their supporters did live and work and study, in some cases for a number of years. It has spread to here to Munich. It has spread to Berlin and Frankfurt. In Frankfurt, there were arrests of several people who these go back to last New Year's, actually, when apparently the Bin Laden network planned simultaneous attacks in several parts of the world, including the Algerian who infiltrated Washington State from Vancouver and with intention to attack Los Angeles Airport, who's been convicted since in the United States, or operations planned in Jordan against tourist hotels and tourist sites. These were thwarted. Here in Germany, the New Year's party was to have been in Strasbourg, France, apparently, attempt to blow up, if possible, the European Parliament there, among other things. And the police have gone back to Frankfurt now, since the attacks in the United States, to further investigate that particular group, and have detained and raided a couple of more, detained more people and raided a couple more localities in Frankfurt in that connection. The financial trail is being followed in Germany carefully, but without much result so far. The central bank and the German federal authorities have frozen 13 bank accounts believed to be associated with Bin Laden. Since 1999, the European Union asked that it be done in 99, and only one of those 13 was frozen after the attacks in the United States this month. But the pickings have been very slim so far. Only $1 million, or I think $1.27 million, has been gleaned in freezing these accounts so far.
Can you just back up for a minute in terms of how they tied the hijackers, the people who they believe to have been the hijackers, to Germany in the first place?
Well, it's very interesting. German journalists that I've been talking to, one just an hour ago, who have worked on law enforcement matters and are very senior, assure me that both the American FBI and the German Counterintelligence Service had these people under surveillance as early as 1998. And German police sources, complain would be too strong a word, but express annoyance that the FBI, they say, did not share all the information they had with the Germans. The FBI is very active in Germany. They've got a full station in Berlin and have had for some time, as the German federal police do in Washington. Mohammed Atta, who piloted the first plane that hit the World Trade Center, was a student at this technical university in Hamburg, as were two of his companions, as was Sabihi and, Shelhi. One of the two Shelhi brothers, at least, studied there. He was piloting the second plane, we think. There was a third man, very important, named Bahaji, who has disappeared. His mother and his wife say that he's gone to Pakistan for an internship and he'll be back, but he's listed as missing and wanted by the German police, and there are warrants out for a number of others of the Hamburg group. The German police remarked that immediately after the attacks in New York, they asked the FBI for anything that would help them in the investigation in Germany, and instantly the FBI produced a full database on these people, particularly against Mohammed Atta, and the Germans were struck by the fact that they must have been under surveillance by the Americans for some time to have built up such a big database.
We're talking to John Cooley. He's author of Unholy Wars, Afghanistan, America, and International Terrorism. So you're saying the FBI was monitoring them even as they were getting trained at U.S. aviation schools?
It would appear that they were monitoring them even in Germany before they left for the U.S.
Do you have any knowledge of them being trained at U.S. military schools?
No, I have. I don't know the details about that. It's been reported in the States, as you know, that they took pilot training in civilian schools. I don't know of military training for these particular people. Of course, the military training for bin Laden-type terrorists goes way back to the Afghan War of 79 to 89, when the CIA and Pakistani military intelligence took charge of training this army of Muslim mercenaries who were to fight and eventually expel the Russians from Afghanistan in the 80s. But more recent military training in the States, I have not heard of.
I want to talk about the CIA and the Mujahideen and your whole investigation of them over many, many years. But first, on the issue of Bush's executive order freezing financial assets, what do you think of it? How do they identify the financial assets of Osama bin Laden? And what do you think in particular of the charity Al Rashid, which is very angry and well known, as I was just reading in the news headlines, about for providing limbs to amputees, supplying sewing machines, is seen throughout Afghanistan, and has been put on the terrorist list.
Right. Well, if I had to characterize the whole effort to identify and run down bin Laden and affiliates' worldwide assets, I would refer to Greek mythology, where, as you know, Hercules was assigned, I think, 12 labors. And this would certainly be the 13th and most difficult of all. It's going to be an immense task. I have just read a 70-page intelligence report. It's over a year old, but extremely detailed, with names and addresses around the world of bin Laden's assets and the companies he has invested in or helped, or and the people and firms he has been associated with in various ways. The list reaches all the way from Saudi Arabia, of course, the bin Laden Construction Group, which is the biggest, still the biggest construction group, I believe, in the world, all the way to the Far East, to Kuala Lumpur, to the Philippines, to the main, to many main European as well as Arab banks. And untangling all this and determining responsibilities and who are the real owners of bank accounts is really a Herculean task, and I would almost think that it might be called Mission Impossible.
So who are the groups whose financial assets have been seized?
Well, they've been listed in the U.S. Media. I think there were 12 or 15. They were mostly individuals known to have been associated with bin Laden, and like Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was an Egyptian surgeon and also sometimes reported to be a psychiatrist, who has been with bin Laden, is probably his main deputy for many years, who lived in Switzerland after his exile from Egypt. He was in charge of one of the most militant Egyptian Islamist groups, the one that whose people originally murdered Anwar Sadat in 81. Zawahiri, just to take this one example, is believed to have controlled bank accounts in Switzerland when he lived there. And, of course, The Arab banks, which have helped bin Laden, the names of them are known. The Saudi Commercial Bank is one that's under great suspicion. It's run by a man named bin Mahfouz, who is a Yemeni, as was bin Laden's father in the bin Laden dynasty, construction dynasty. Their origins were Yemen. The list goes on and on, and it includes people in the city of London, includes people in the United States, in New York, and the job of sorting these out is going to be immense.
We're talking to John Cooley. He is the author of Unholy Wars, Afghanistan, America, and International Terrorism. We're going to be back with him in just a minute. We're also going to have a debate later in the program over whether the U.S. should fund the Northern Alliance, which is fighting the Taliban in northern Afghanistan. And in our second hour, Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese peace activist and Buddhist monk, will speak. It's a recording of his speech last night at the historic Riverside Church in New York, where thousands came to hear his words. We're also going to talk about where the money for war comes from. We'll talk about the effects of military spending on poor people in the United States. Stay with us.
East. The edge of the world. West. Those who came before me. When my father died, we put him in the ground. When my father died, it was like a whole library burned down. World without end.
World without end, Laurie Anderson here on Ground Zero Radio's War and Peace Report. This is Democracy Now in Exile. I'm Amy Goodman. The New York Times is reporting today German police are investigating financial ties between two hijackers who rammed airplanes into the World Trade Center towers and a Syrian businessman who controls a Hamburg bank account belonging to a founder of Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda terrorist network. If the links were proved, they would appear to provide strong evidence of al-Qaeda's involvement in the September 11th attacks on the Trade Center and the Pentagon. We are talking to John Cooley, who is a longtime investigator of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, wrote the book Unholy Wars, Afghanistan, America, and International Terrorism, and is a longtime U.S. correspondent. You are speaking to him in Munich, Germany. What about this latest information? And are you convinced that the al-Qaeda network is behind the September 11th attacks?
Well, the signs point that way. The Syrian gentleman that you mentioned is actually a German citizen. His name is Mahmoud Darkazanli. He had a one-man company in Hamburg. The police questioned him, but did not arrest him, and then he seemed to vanish, but he's reappeared now in Berlin. He gave an interview to the Financial Times of London. He denied any link to the hijackers or terrorists, but he did admit that he was doing business and controlled a bank account belonging to Mamdou Mahmoud Salim, who has almost certainly been a senior financial aide to bin Laden, who was extradited from Germany to the United States and faces terrorism charges now in the United States. Darkazanli has lived in Germany for 18 years. He's got, as I said, he has German citizenship. And the bank account in question was, of course, in a Hamburg bank. But these things are very elusive, and the Germans don't have enough information to charge him with anything. It's all supposition and suspicion based on this one circumstance that he controlled the bank account of this man, Salim. And you could repeat similar examples from many, many places, especially in Europe.
Salim is also charged, the man who is being held in the United States, awaiting trial, both on charges he participated in bin Laden's, as the Times put it, global terrorism conspiracy, and that he stabbed and critically wounded a guard last November 1st at the federal prison in Lower Manhattan. He has pled not guilty to all charges. Let's go, John Cooley, to your investigation of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and your book. Can you talk about how the Mujahideen got their start, as well as the involvement of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency?
When the Soviets invaded Afghanistan in December 1979, and just as the American countermeasures were not unanimously decided by the Carter administration, the Soviet operation was not unanimously decided at all. It was Brezhnev and Andropov and a couple of other Politburo members. And as an appendix to my book, you can find a Soviet declassified Soviet document, the minutes of the Politburo meeting that decided on this. And you'll see how few people wanted to do it and how many, even some of the Soviet senior military people, opposed it. Anyway, when it happened, the Carter administration decided, and certainly Mr. Brzezinski, Zbigniew Brzezinski, this national security advisor, was very prominent in this decision, to recruit a worldwide network of Muslims. They were actually mercenaries because they were very well paid. They were volunteers, and they came from all of the Muslim and Arab countries, and they came from Muslim communities in non-Muslim states, such as the United States. There were American black Muslims and others from Los Angeles and Brooklyn and other places in the U.S. They came from the Philippines. They came from Iran. They came from Turkey. The program was managed by the CIA. The CIA in the United States trained in their camps and in Army and Navy SEAL Special Forces camps the trainers of the Mujahideen, and those trainers were mostly senior Pakistani military officers, many of them from ISI, which is the Pakistani Intelligence Service, umbrella intelligence service called Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate, which is extremely powerful, which incidentally fathered the Taliban and probably still watches them very closely and has been helping them all along. But they took charge of the program. My view is, and this is my personal judgment, and I express in the book, that it was a mistake to hire mercenaries to do this job. The Carter administration, of course, didn't want to send the U.S. military into Afghanistan to fight the Russians. They didn't want a Russian-American war, and that's extremely understandable. But the second and much more serious error, in my view, was that once this was decided and the program begun, the Pakistanis, President Zia-ul-Haq, General Zia-ul-Haq, who was the virtual dictator of Pakistan then, was given total control by the Carter administration of all of the supply, the financing, the arming, and even the deployment in some cases of the seven main Mujahideen guerrilla groups. And the CIA was allowed only to help finance it, to send the material, in some rare cases to send some senior CIA officers to Pakistan for special training tasks, such as the Stinger missile, which really, in 1985-86, turned the war around and gave victory to the Mujahideen and the coalition supporting them, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and some others, Britain. The this involvement of the Pakistanis, this control, made it possible for the Pakistanis, after the war was over and the Russians were gone, when the Americans turned their back on Afghanistan, they didn't care anymore what happened. The country was in misery and in ruins, but there was very little American concern about what went on after, once the Russians were out. Well, the Pakistani military continued to train guerrillas for their own agendas, especially Kashmir, and still do. I see that only today the bank accounts of one of the Kashmiri groups has been frozen by Pakistan. That is quite a radical step for them to take, and it shows that General Musharraf really means what he says when he's going to help the Americans. But the guerrillas continue to train, and bin Laden himself, who was acting as a helper for Saudi intelligence, working parallel with the CIA, building military installations for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, the tunnels and caves, which, ironically, the United States attacked with cruise missiles after our embassies in East Africa were bombed in August 98. Bin Laden was an important contributor to all this effort, but always with the controlling hand of the Pakistanis on it. And to a lesser extent, Saudi intelligence, which supported him and supported one or two of the seven main Mujahideen groups. That support continued in some cases after the war was over, and one of those seems to have been the Abu Sayyaf group, which was transplanted to the Philippines. They were the youngest of the seven Mujahideen groups. Their founder, who was an Afghani professor of Islamic studies, named Professor Abdul Rasul Abu Sayyaf, founded what was really a terrorism university, as the New York Times termed it, outside Islamabad. Now, these people were transplanted to the Philippines, and they became little more than a kidnap gang, and they've made quite a lot of money kidnapping and holding people, including Americans, for ransom there, and they're still doing it. So you see the consequences of Pakistani control and lack of American control have extended this contagion all around the world. Egypt, Algeria, Sudan, the Philippines, New York, the World Trade Center bombing in 93, these and many other terrorist acts were perpetrated by the alumni of the Afghan War, and the Arab volunteers are still called the Arab Afghanis in their own countries, and many of them are wanted, and some of them are under death sentences in absentia. Bin Laden was simply a coordinator of many of these activities.
We're talking to John Cooley, U.S. correspondent and author who's covered North Africa and the Middle East for 40 years. In a minute, we're going to have a debate on whether the U.S. should fund the Northern Alliance, which is fighting in northern Afghanistan against the Taliban. But I wanted to ask you, first, have you met Osama bin Laden?
No, I have never met Osama bin Laden myself. A few journalists have. A few Western journalists have, and several and more Pakistani journalists have. But he has now chosen the Al Jazeera television network based in the Gulf in Doha and Qatar, which is a relatively independent and free-thinking liberal, if you like, Arab television network, not under the influence of any government, except they probably would not attack the Saudi royal family, but they will attack almost any other icon in the Arab world. Bin Laden now has chosen them as his selected outlet, and when he has something to say, he makes a tape for them. This has happened again quite recently, and I have never ever encountered him, and I have no direct knowledge of him through meeting him.
What is the privatization of terror?
Well, I call the privatization of terror the gradual relaxation or the gradual drying up of government funds from the United States, from Saudi Arabia, from other contributors such as Egypt. Towards the end of the war, towards the end of the 80s, the end of the Afghan war when the Soviets were about to withdraw and were withdrawing, this was replaced by private fortunes of men and companies like Osama bin Laden and his construction companies. It was replaced by certain Arab banks. It was replaced by certain financiers. But by far the most important was Osama bin Laden. Now, another aspect of privatization of terrorism has been the income from the drug traffic. And as I point out in my book, both the United States and the Soviet Union encouraged or tolerated, certainly encouraged is the proper word in some cases, the drug traffic in Afghanistan to earn money to finance the war. And that became more and more important as the output of opium base, or rather morphine base and even refined heroin became greater and greater through the years, the last years of the war, and into and through the 90s as well, until Afghanistan, until very recently when the Taliban seemed to be clamping down on it, was the biggest source of opium and its products in the world, along with Burma and some of the Golden Triangle countries in the Far East. So drug traffic was another important source of the privatization of terrorism, and still is. This is true also in the Balkans, where Mujahideen veterans have fought in Bosnia and in Kosovo and are still there. They have had some bases in Albania, and there's a very lively traffic in drugs and arms there, which certainly goes to finance various guerrilla and terrorist causes, including some that have been backed by the West, such as the Kosovo Liberation Army, the UCK, as they call it.
There was some talk in Belgrade, our correspondent Jeremy Scahill said, of Osama bin Laden being connected to the KLA.
Yes, the Serbs believe that. And I have seen reports, I've seen Greek reports, that maybe bin Laden even in person visited the Balkans, although I think that's doubtful. But certainly people affiliated with him have worked with the KLA. There's no doubt about that. And mostly from, as I say, bases originally in Albania, but now you see traces of this in Macedonia, and as always in Kosovo. That was the European aspect of bin Laden's very, very loose but very widespread network.
Let me ask, as an opening to the debate we're about to have when we end with you, whether you think that the U.S. should be funding the Northern Alliance in their battle with the Taliban.
The U.S. ignored pretty much the Northern Alliance when they were fighting very hard and almost came at one point a couple of years ago. It seemed likely that they might recapture Kabul. But as far as I know, there was little or no American aid to them. I think perhaps this is the moment when the U.S. should get involved in helping them, even though Ahmad Shah Massoud is dead. He's been killed by terrorists, probably associated with bin Laden. The Northern Alliance fights on, and they do control some strategic territory, perhaps 5% of the country. And the U.S. badly needs allies on the ground. It needs local allies, and those are the most likely. I would help them.
I want to thank you for being with us, John Cooley. Again, he is author of the book Unholy Wars, Afghanistan, America, and International Terrorism, U.S. correspondent and author who's covered North Africa and the Middle East for 40 years, speaking to us from Munich, Germany, the site of a large part of the investigation into who hijacked the planes that rammed into the World Trade Center towers and the Pentagon. You're listening to Democracy Now! In Exile. When we come back, a debate on the Northern Alliance and whether the U.S. should fund them. And in our second hour, we'll hear Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese peace activist who spoke last night at Riverside Church. Thousands of people came out to hear him as the Buddhist monk talked about anger, war, and peace. We'll also have a discussion about what happens to poor people in times of war, war and welfare. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report as we broadcast just blocks from where the World Trade Center towers once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. Long after Soviet forces withdrew from Afghanistan in 1979, the country remained in violent upheaval. Many Afghans who opposed the fundamentalist Islamic regime of the Taliban, which took power in 1996, support the North Alliance Party, or the Mujahideen. But others say the Northern Alliance is responsible for as many human rights abuses and physical destruction as the Taliban and the invading Soviet forces are. The Afghan Northern Alliance is made up of an ethnically and religiously disparate group of rebel movements, mainly non-Pashtun ethnic groups. Pashtuns are the majority ethnic group in Afghanistan. General Ahmed Shah Massoud, the leader of the alliance, was killed earlier this month, just 2 days before the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon. Massoud made a series of alliances with former opponents, some of whom the Taliban had driven into exile. Massoud's death might well have meant the end of the alliance if the bombing of the World Trade Center and Pentagon had not inspired possible U.S. moves to take military action against Osama bin Laden and his Taliban backers. The alliance's political leaders are confident now that their enemy will be eliminated and have stated that they're willing to fight alongside the Americans against the Taliban. We're joined now by Noor Delawari, who fled Afghanistan for the U.S. the year Afghanistan's monarchy was overthrown. In 1993, Noor Delawari traveled to Italy with California Congressmember Dana Rohrabacher to meet the former Afghan king, Mohammad Zahir Shah, who ruled Afghanistan for 40 years. At the meeting, Afghanistan's former king launched a peace initiative for Afghanistan, which describes its aims as ending the Afghan conflict, appointing a head of state, and establishing a transitional government. We're joined on the phone now by Noor Delawari, an advisory board member of the Afghanistan Foundation, as well as Sonali Kohatar, who is vice president of the Afghans Women's Mission, and Jim Engels on the board of directors of the Afghan Women's Mission. Well, let's start off with Noor Delawari. We did just hear in the last few days that the U.S. government had sent representatives to Italy to meet with the king. To talk about, and this was reported in British newspapers, the possibility of the king returning in being supported by the Northern Alliance and taking power in a post-Taliban government in Afghanistan. Is that true?
That is true. There has been a meeting, still there is a meeting going on in Rome with a former king. Representatives from the United Nations and also a group of U.S. congressmen are about to go to meet with the former king this week. The former king himself has never said that he will go to Afghanistan. However, he has introduced a mechanism, the Lohi Jirga, which is an Afghan traditional way of electing, resolving major issues in the country. And that has been tested for almost 1,000 years. So that, we believe, is very crucial at this time. While the Northern Alliance, I think, will help, particularly the Americans, to keep the collateral damage at minimum, or the life of those American service military personnel who might be landing in Afghanistan. They need logistic help from someone. The Northern Alliance will be helpful. However, I, as Afghan American, do not believe that the Northern Alliance will be a solution to come and take over and offer a government for the people. However, they in the past have agreed to this process of Lohi Jirga, or the Grand Assembly. I think their help at this time will be meaningful. Also, they have, I hear some people, they don't like them up, you know, for whatever reason. Let's say that without Northern Alliance, today, Taliban would have had the entire country. And it would have been very, very difficult for anybody to go after the terrorists in Afghanistan. And we have the, as far as I'm concerned, that terrorist, Bin Laden, and his 20,000 people, as John Cooley said, their root is back in mid-80s. But particularly that's something I don't hear that much, that the Taliban's are the products of certain foreign countries' as plans. And going back to mid-80s, creating these madrasas in Pakistan, the purpose of these madrasas were to train Talib at that time. So these young men were taken from the Afghan refugee camps and put in these kind of crash courses, not Islamic, but militant Islamic schools. So they would use Islam against the Soviet Union at that time, against communism. So when the Soviet Union ended, and then these Talibs were all there. During the time when they established these madrasas in Pakistan, and it was an agreement between the United States and Saudi Arabia. I think John Cooley touched on that. There are money coming to helping the resistance in Afghanistan. Part of the money was coming to earmark for the establishment of these schools in Pakistan. The man who was the money was coming from private sectors and collected in mosques and places in Saudi Arabia, and that money was being distributed to these young Talibs to the madrasas by whom? By Osama bin Laden, and so he had his contact established at that time when the Soviet Union so prematurely withdrew from Afghanistan, because if you go back, your documents shows that the United States and other countries were helping the Mujahideens. They were thinking that this will go for a long time, up to 20, 25 years.
Noor Dilawari, I want to bring Jim Ingalls into the discussion on the board of directors of Afghan Women's Mission. You wrote a piece in Z Magazine about the Northern Alliance. Can you talk a little about your perspective on the Northern Alliance and whether you think the U.S. should support it?
Hi. Yes. Well, my piece in Z Magazine was actually about the sanctions on Afghanistan and what one of the conclusions that that resulted was that the Northern Alliance was essentially given tacit approval by the UN Security Council in imposing sanctions on only the Taliban and not the opposing factions, who were also guilty of just as many human rights abuses and commission of violence within Afghanistan. One thing that I think maybe listeners aren't aware is that the Northern Alliance has been essentially given a very good PR in an interesting way by the U.S. government and by its media, because as John Cooley mentioned, during the 1980s, the Northern Alliance were separate factions of the Mujahideen, which were fighting for the United States and others to end the Soviet occupation. When the Soviets left in 1989, the Mujahideen groups began attacking the city of Kabul, attacking other parts of Afghanistan that were held by the Soviet puppet regime. And soon after, when the puppet regime collapsed, one of the groups seized Kabul, Massoud's group, under President Rabbani. And the other groups, most prominently Gulbuddin Hekmatyar's group, began attacking Kabul. And Kabul, at the end of the Soviet occupation, was still standing. By 1994, it was completely in rubble, and that was after Mujahideen rocket shelling using weapons that the U.S. supplied, and the U.S. government essentially ignored. This is when according to Cooley, right, the U.S. government kind of abandoned the Mujahideen. At the same time as abandoning them, the U.S. Media coverage completely dropped by a factor of about five. I've measured it, five articles to one. In the time when the Soviets were there, the media coverage was tremendous. When the Mujahideen were destroying Kabul, media coverage was near zero. So this is effectively a PR for the Northern Alliance.
You want to respond to that, Noor Delwar?
Yes, of course, because first of all, Mujahideen were all forces fighting the Soviet Union. There was no Ahmad Shah Massoud was the strongest Mujahid who fought the Soviet Union independently, particularly independent of Pakistan. When you're referring to certain atrocities committed, yes, I'm aware, and there's been while it was publicized that the government which was responsible to look after Afghanistan after the Soviet withdrawal was made in Pakistan, in Lahore. It was sent to Kabul under the command of President Mujaddidi. And then the Massoud or the Northern Alliance had very little to do with the security of people in Kabul. Massoud was named at that time as the defense minister. He, in the same time, when they came to Kabul and Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, which was another head of one of the factions in Pakistan, he came and started to take over from first Mujaddidi and then Rabbani's people. But let's be clear on it. There were no two groups of Mujahideens. The ones who were the real Mujahideens were those from Afghanistan, like Massoud. We should not hold him responsible for the killings, for the atrocities committed. And let's go back at this time and in the recent time that Northern Alliance, which is made of several groups of Mujahideens, some of these were not part of the government which was established in Pakistan.
Let me get a response from Sonali Kohatar, Vice President of the Afghan Women's Mission, as to the human rights record of the Northern Alliance and how it's perceived on the ground in Afghanistan.
Definitely, as Mr. Delawari says, Massoud was more independent of Pakistan than any of the Mujahideen factions. He was also the most moderate of all the Mujahideen factions. It's important to note that the party that got the most funding from the United States, about half the funding in weapons and training, was Gulbuddin Hekmatyar's party, who was the most extreme. And I can talk a little bit about that later on. But coming back to Massoud, you know, he's certainly not innocent of crimes against humanity. They aren't as vast as the rest of the Mujahideen, but just an example, in the year following the takeover of Kabul, or the entrance of entrance of Massoud into Kabul in 1992, in February of 93, Massoud attacked Kabul, bombing Hekmatyar's bases, and in fact, some of the worst atrocities have been reported to be committed on February 11th, where they entered a suburb of ethnic Hazara people, killing up to 1,000 civilians, beheading people, shoving them down wells. I mean, this is documented in several books. One particular one that I can name is Michael Griffin's book, Reaping the Whirlwind. And, you know, certainly he's not guilty of killing tens of thousands of people, but, you know, on the order of a few hundred to 1,000, and probably more than that. And, you know, this is all often referred to as his biggest mistake kind of thing. So, you know, and he was a very, very charismatic figure, certainly a leader in terms of the way in which he, you know, tried to get the Mujahideen to work with one another and to form some sort of coalition. But I think it's very important to just be clear here and get a perspective on who these people were. These are guerrilla fighters that were funded by the United States to fight off the Soviets, not in any way trained or prepared to rule a country, or in any way prepared to be responsible for the country, for running the country as a whole. And it's interesting to think of what's going to happen when the Taliban are beaten, if they are beaten, because you just have to go back and look at what was happening before the Taliban came into power. In 1996, when they came into power, the 4 years preceding that, the Mujahideen were fighting one another in a terrible way, as Jim mentioned, really destroyed Kabul, about 45,000 civilians killed. This was happening before the Taliban came into power, and this kind of destruction, this kind of complete meltdown of infrastructure allowed, in a sense, the Taliban to come and take over with the ease that they did. What's to say that these people aren't going to turn upon themselves and fight one another once more now that they've got the backing of the United States once more? We see sort of this repeat of history.
Well, Sonali, we're going to have to continue this discussion in the coming days, and we'll also be having you on to talk about women in Afghanistan, an extended segment that we will be doing tomorrow. But that does it for today. Sonali Kohatar and Jim Engels are with the Afghan Women's Mission. Noor Delawari, an advisory board member of the Afghanistan Foundation and president of Delaware International Banking System and chair of the Afghanistan Relief Organization. If you'd like to write us, you can send us email at mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland is at the helm at WBIX.org. Special thanks to Chase Pearson, Tony Riddle, Rick Youngers, Hoi No, Karen Renucci, Didi Halleck, Tom Poole, Lenny Charles, and our hosts here at Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Suno. And thank you to the Pacifica stations, especially KPFA and KFCF in Fresno. Of course, all our affiliate stations around the country, we are Pacifica. Our cameramen today are Sam Delgado and Charles Krizel, as well as Karen Renucci. You can see Democracy Now in Exile on Channel 34 and 56 on Manhattan Neighborhood Network, as well as on Free Speech TV, Channel 9415 on Dish TV Satellite Network. We are in the historic firehouse of Engine 31 in the evacuation zone, in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the band and the fire, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. If you ask them to fight again, what do you think they'd say? I'm not trying to be funny, I'm just trying to get my point across. War is world's enemy number one, and it's time that we called it off. Ow! Stop the war! From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
Hearings have just begun on the renewal of the legislation that we call welfare reform, hearings in the Congress. The outcome of those hearings is very uncertain. On the one hand, Welfare reform has brought increased hardship to many women raising children on their own, and there will be more hardship as these women approach the 5-year term limit.
Today, a discussion on war and welfare. Then we'll hear from Buddhist Vietnamese peace activist Thich Nhat Hanh.
Our deepest desire should be to love, to help, and not to revenge, not to punish, not to kill. And I am confident that New Yorkers have that wisdom.
All that and more coming up on the War and Peace Report. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile's War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the World Trade Center towers once stood. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration yesterday advanced its diplomatic effort to wage war on Osama bin Laden and Afghanistan's Taliban regime, securing a renunciation of the Taliban by Saudi Arabia and Russian consent to use former Soviet air bases for U.S. strikes. And Russian Defense Minister Sergei Ivanov has said the United States can use military facilities in Tajikistan to launch strikes on neighboring Afghanistan, marking the first time Russia has publicly approved what would be an unprecedented U.S. military presence in former Soviet Central Asia. The Pentagon yesterday changed the code name of its military buildup to Operation Enduring Freedom. The change was made after the initial name, Operation Infinite Justice, ran into objections from Islamic scholars on grounds that only God or Allah could mete out infinite justice and that the operation's name was a religious insult. The Voice of America broadcast a rare interview with the leader of Afghanistan's Taliban yesterday, 4 days after outraged State Department officials argued that he should not be given a taxpayer-financed platform. The report by Ed Warner of Voice of America sandwiched portions of the interview between a review of President Bush's speech to Congress last week and commentary by an academic expert and a representative of the Taliban's opponents, the Northern Alliance. The reaction of the State Department, which until 2 years ago had direct control over VOA operations and still retains a seat on the independent agency's governing board, prompted more than 100 Voice of America employees to protest in a letter to newspapers that their work was being censored. And the Senate passed legislation yesterday that would remove all trade barriers between the United States and Jordan after the Bush administration persuaded a pivotal Republican senator to drop his objections. Meanwhile, in a speech Monday to the Institute for International Economics, Robert Zoellick, the U.S. trade representative, encouraged Congress to grant the president fast-track authority. And Alan Greenspan, the Federal Reserve Chair, told the Senate Banking Committee that the United States should use the outpouring of international support to develop support for a new round of global trade talks. We're joined on the line from Washington by Lori Wallach, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Your response to these moves?
This is some of the most crass political profiteering I have ever seen in all the years I've been in Washington. Basically, Zoellick and the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, a guy named Thomas from Illinois, have gone on a personal mission to abuse the tragedy to try and further their special interest agenda, knowing that the huge outpouring of opposition from across the country to fast-track more NAFTA expansions had basically put their plans on ice. They're now using a rally-around-the-flag approach. Zoellick, in just the most disgusting speech I may have ever read, announced that there were direct links between the protesters against globalization and the terrorists who blew up the World Trade Center, and further gave it, you're with us or we're with them, them being folks who aren't for fast track. It's really the only upside about this, because it's so tawdry, it's so unseemly, it's so depressing, that members of Congress have found it repulsive as well, and there's a backlash is growing. But there really is what I would call a stealth attempt to use what is a stand down by all of the critics of fast track, because the Congress and the country is focused on the crisis, and these special interests are trying to exploit that to push what would otherwise be a hopeless agenda.
So how are you mobilizing against it?
Well, it's really important, actually, for people to start calling the members of Congress again. And the irony is they need to do it very delicately because it's the other side that's been so crass and tawdry. We don't want to be like them. So the message needs to be, and folks need to do this immediately, you know, this isn't the time for this debate. This is a very contentious debate. Fast track specifically and globalization generally are amongst the most contentious issues, and we need that debate, and we're eager for it. But now is not the time, because, in fact, the Congress needs to focus on immediately the many people whose lives and jobs and homes have been destroyed by the crisis, needs to figure out how to avoid future attacks. And this is the kind of issue that would just blow apart any possibility for Congress to work on those short-term issues. And that is the message that folks need to make with to the members of Congress, with a footnote of saying, and by the way, if the other side wants to really push this and cause this horrible divisiveness right now, of course, we will passionately fight and we will win. But it's not necessary. It's the wrong time. It's the wrong tone. We can deal with it later. It's a fight we need to have, but not now.
Finally, Phil Gramm of Texas's opposition to the trade agreement with Jordan. What's your assessment of the agreement and why he opposed it?
He opposed the agreement because the agreement has the first modest steps towards putting environmental and labor language in the core text of a trade agreement. And the Jordan Agreement is, in fact, a very modest step in that direction. It is not anything vaguely like the basis for future trade agreements or for a model to come out for fast track. And Gramm opposed even those modest steps, whereas the great consensus of, frankly, almost all the Democrats, including those who in the past have supported trade agreements that environmental and labor and consumer groups have opposed, is that, in fact, future trade agreements must, in their core text, have much better provisions for human rights and labor and environment and democracy and food safety, and that the Jordan Agreement, while a step in the right direction, is no model. But the Republicans are so extreme against anything but trade uber alles that Gramm was putting up a fuss.
Lori Wallach, I want to thank you for being with us, Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Fight the Power, Public Enemy, here on Democracy Now in Exile's War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In the last 2 weeks, the thousands of people affected by the attacks on the World Trade Center have received unprecedented levels of assistance from federal, state, and local agencies. Agencies have generally made drastic cuts in red tape to facilitate the flow of aid and employed extremely generous standards in determining who receives it, including housing, food, and disaster assistance. The aid has gone to victims of the disaster regardless of income, and therein lies the irony. For the Giuliani administration continues to discourage poor people from applying for public aid and housing assistance in New York. Outside of New York, millions of poor people around the country are running up against federal and state-imposed time limits on the receipt of public assistance, the result of the Welfare Act of 1996, which placed strict limits on who can receive assistance and for how long. The so-called Welfare Reform Act will come up for reauthorization at a moment when the Bush administration and Congress are pouring billions of dollars into military and intelligence agencies and telling the public that the U.S. is in for a drawn-out military struggle that will require public sacrifice on a number of fronts. But who will sacrifice the most? We're joined now by Frances Fox Piven, professor of social and political science at CUNY, and author of the landmark book Regulating the Poor, as well as many other books and articles on public assistance and public policy. And Sherry Honkola joins us on the line, who's head of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union in Philadelphia, one of the nation's first welfare rights groups. Welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Glad to be here, Amy.
Well, it's great to have you. What are your thoughts first on welfare and war?
Well, it really is a moment of great uncertainty. It could be that the sense of national emergency, the sense that we're on the brink of war, will lead to a spirit of compassion, and there will be more space for people who are advocates of the poor to raise issues like the increase in poverty that has occurred among single women raising children on their own since welfare reform. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, there'll be pressure on spending in Washington because we're going to have to spend so much on war preparation and making war and on intelligence. It isn't that welfare spending looms so large in the federal budget. It's actually a rather small amount, but it's a relatively easy target for the spending cutters. So both of those possibilities loom ahead of us. And much depends, I think, on the way in which advocates of the poor themselves, mobilize to enter the political discussion.
Sherry Honkola, if history is any guide, what do you think we can expect? What can we expect to happen to public assistance to the poor if President Bush, as he is doing now, mobilizes for war?
Well, the day that the tragedy happened in New York City, the absolute sadness of poor families all around the country because of the terrible things that had happened to the families that died both in New York City and Washington, D.C., but also there was a great deal of sadness because of the fact that poor families will become ever more so invisible, and the conditions that they face and the issues that they're up against will virtually be made to, you know, disappear as the media focuses on trying to organize aid for the families that are victims in this situation, as well as Congress talks about gathering tons of money to go to war. We knew that even before this tragedy happened in our country, that the criminalization of the poor was very much increasing across the country, preparing for the 5-year lifetime limit for folks that are on public assistance, because people are having to house themselves any way that they possibly can and feed themselves any way that they can. And the police were already making, things very difficult for families across the country.
We are watching as the stock market goes down, certainly after the World Trade Center attacks. There was a report, I can't remember on which of the corporate media networks, talking about the incident at the World Trade Center and the Wall Street Massacre, believe it or not, that framing of it. In the papers today, articles on new economic statistics showing that poverty in the U.S. declined in 2000, with poverty rates of blacks and female heads of households the lowest on record. At the same time, median income has leveled off after years of growth. And another piece about how more than 100,000 New York City workers are likely to find themselves unemployed, at least temporarily, as a result of the World Trade Center disaster. Francis Fox Piven, you've written extensively about the use of public assistance as a means of the state to control poor people's labor, especially in times of economic downturn. So can you fit this into this picture now in the wake of the attacks?
Well, it's important to recognize that public assistance is used to control people's labor, largely by refusing public assistance, and that the most important social control or labor market effects of public assistance occur when public assistance is slashed, and it's slashed usually to the accompaniment of a great deal of rhetoric blaming the poor for their poverty, tracing poverty to the fact that poor women have too many babies, for example, an old Malthusian argument. And we've seen this in the United States, this kind of argument, to almost a drumbeat created by right-wing foundations and right-wing politicians. This argument has prevailed over the last 10 years in the U.S. So when we look at the results of welfare reform, which was really welfare cutback, welfare slashing, to channel these impoverished mothers into the low-wage labor market, whether or not they could actually get jobs, they would be looking for jobs. When we look at the results, our politicians tell us, well, it's a success because so many people are no longer on welfare. Well, there's no trick to that. All you have to do is cut them off welfare or refuse them assistance when they try to apply, something that the Giuliani administration is very good at and one of the leaders in the country, actually, at what is called diversion. The results of that are that many more women are crowding the labor market, scrambling for whatever jobs are available. The results are also that many more women are deeply impoverished, and so are their children. But we don't look at this because we've been persuaded by the argument that welfare is the problem, that welfare is not good for people, that welfare causes poverty, that welfare causes dependence, that welfare leads women to have out-of-wedlock babies. All of these are arguments for which there is absolutely no evidence, but it does sort of pluck at certain kinds of animosities that are rooted in American culture and in American history. So if no one else is speaking and speaking loudly, people go along with that argument.
What about these hearings in Washington?
Well, the hearings so far have been House hearings. The argument that has to be made by advocates for increased generosity to the poor, the argument that has to be made is that the cut in the welfare rolls, more than half the people who were on the welfare rolls are now off the welfare rolls, that this slashing of the welfare rolls is not by itself any evidence of success. All it means is that people have been refused assistance. And the reason that we inaugurated welfare programs in this country was because, at least at certain periods in our history, we have been convinced that a community owed assistance to those who were worst off in the community. And the promise of this period, this spirit of national emergency, this the rise of a spirit of compassion and almost togetherness in the wake of the emergency is that we will be able to remind Americans that the problem is not just that people got a little bit of assistance from government, but the problem is poverty, the poverty of women and children, who even when they go to work only make $6, $7, $8 an hour.
We're watching all sorts of legislation being pushed through that doesn't appear to have any connection to the mobilization for war, but the administration using this as an opportunity, a kind of laying out a wish list that they have a window right now where Bush has unprecedented popularity. It may come as a shock to some, something like the most popularity of any president in history, according to polls. And so they're trying to push through everything they can on every issue, from fast track to getting rid of any restriction on ABM treaties. Or where do you see that fitting into your work on the economy and welfare?
Well, I think that one of the reasons that Bush is scoring overwhelmingly in the popularity scores is that he has softened his warrior rhetoric, and he is talking about other non-military solutions to the terrorist emergency, so that there's some basis for people thinking that he is indeed a leader, the leader of all the people. Were he to now attack poor women and children. Were he to take the kind of line that Gingrich took, for example, in leading the country to the passage of welfare reform, I think he would lose popularity. I don't think he's going to do that. We can't be sure, but I don't think that he's going to come down hard on poor women and children.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us and coming over to the firehouse where we are in Chinatown. And speaking of New York politics, we didn't even mention yet in the program that the primary did take place yesterday. It was suspended on September 11th, the day of the attacks in New York, in Washington. And yesterday, the results of that primary were that on the Republican side, Michael Bloomberg, the billionaire communications entrepreneur, trounced his opponent, Herman Badillo, to become the Republican mayoral candidate in the general election November 6th. And the Democrats extended the primary contest by an additional 16 days because of a runoff. And that runoff will be between Mark Green, who is the public advocate of New York, and Fernando Ferrer. If Fernando Ferrer were to become mayor, the Bronx borough president, he would be the first Latino mayor of New York. Frances Fox Piven, I want to thank you very much for being with us, professor at CUNY at the City University of New York, and also Sherry Honkala, who is the executive director of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union in Philadelphia. When we come back from our break, we will go to Riverside Church to a major address that was given last night by the Vietnamese Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh in this time of war. Stay with us. Money That Matters, Randy Newman here on Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report, Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. One of the things we've tried to do here on Democracy Now! In Exile is bring the voices of people from New York and around the world who've been victimized by the terror but continue to speak out for peace. As people in the United States struggle with the question of how to respond to the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon and the certainty of U.S. military action in Central Asia, these voices are more important than ever. Thich Nhat Hanh spoke last night at Riverside Church. He's a Vietnamese Buddhist monk. During the war in Vietnam, he worked tirelessly for reconciliation between North and South Vietnam. He championed a movement known as Engaged Buddhism, which intertwined traditional meditative practices with active nonviolent civil disobedience against the South Vietnamese government and the U.S. Martin Luther King Jr. nominated him for the Nobel Peace Prize in 1967. Thich Nhat Hanh's Buddhist delegation to the Paris Peace Talks resulted in accords between North Vietnam and the United States, but his pacifist efforts did not end with the war. He also helped organize rescue missions well into the 1970s for Vietnamese trying to escape from political oppression. He now lives in exile in a small community in France called Plum Village. Thich Nhat Hanh has written more than 75 books of prose, poetry, and prayers, and continues to be banned from his native country of Vietnam. He spoke last night at the historic Riverside Church in Manhattan, where Martin Luther King first spoke out publicly against the Vietnam War. The subject of Thich Nhat Hanh's talk that thousands gathered for was embracing anger. And today we will bring you the first half of that speech, and we will continue it tomorrow. This is Thich Nhat Hanh.
My dear friends, I would like to tell you how I practice when I get angry. During the war in Vietnam, there was a lot of injustice, and many thousands of friends of mine, many disciples of mine were killed. I got very angry. One time I learned that the city of Bến Tre, 300,000 people, was bombarded by American aviation just because some guerrillas came to the city and tried to shoot down American aircraft. They did not succeed, and after that they went away, and the city was destroyed. And the military man who was responsible for that declared later that he had to destroy the city of Bến Tre in order to save it. I was very angry. But at that time, I was already a practitioner, solid practitioner. I did not say anything. I did not act, because I knew that acting or saying things while you are angry is not wise. It may create a lot of destruction. I went back to myself, recognizing my anger, embracing it, and look deeply into the nature of my suffering. In the Buddhist tradition, we have the practice of mindful breathing, mindful walking, to generate the energy of mindfulness. It is exactly with that energy of mindfulness that we can recognize, embrace, and transform our anger. Mindfulness is the kind of energy that helps us to be aware of what is going on inside of us and around us. And everybody can be mindful. When you drink a cup of tea, and if you know that you are drinking tea, that is mindful drinking. When you breathe in, and if you know that you are breathing in, and if you focus your attention on your in-breath, that is mindfulness of breathing. When you make a step, and if you are aware that you are making a step, that is called mindfulness of walking. And the basic practice in the Zen centers, meditation centers, is the practice of generating the energy of mindfulness every moment of your daily life. And when you are angry, you are aware that you are angry. And because you do have already the energy of mindfulness in you, created by the practice, that is why you have enough of it in order to recognize, embrace, look deeply, and understand the nature of our suffering. I was able to understand the nature of the suffering in Vietnam. I saw that not only Vietnamese suffer, but America suffered as well during the war in Vietnam. The American young men who were sent to Vietnam to kill and to be killed, they underwent a lot of suffering. and the suffering continues even today. Their family, their nation, also. I could see that the cause of our suffering in Vietnam is not the American soldiers. It is a kind of policy that is not wise. It is a misunderstanding. It is fear that lies at the foundation of the policy. And many of us in Vietnam have had burned themselves in order to call for a cessation of the destruction. We did not want to inflict pain on other people. We want to take the pain on ourselves in order to get the message across. But the sound of bombs and mortars was too loud. People in the world, not many of them, were capable to hear us. So I decided to go to America and call for a cessation of the violence. That was in 1966, and because of that, I was prevented to go home, and I began my exile since that time, 1966. Because I was able to see that the real enemy of man is not the real enemy of man is not man. It is ignorance, discrimination, fear, craving, and violence. And that is why I did not have hate vis-a-vis the American people, the American nation. So I came in order to plead for a kind of looking deeply so that your government could revise that policy. I remember I met with Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, and I told him the truth about the suffering. He kept me with him for a long time, and he listened deeply to me, and I was very grateful for his quality of listening. And 3 months later, when the war was intensified, I hear that he resigned from his post. Hatred and anger was not in my heart. That is why I was listened to by many young people in my country, advocating them to follow the path of reconciliation. And together we have helped bring about the negotiations for peace in Paris. I hope my friends here in New York are able to practice the same. I understand suffering and injustice. And I feel that I understand deeply the suffering of New York, of America. I feel I am a New Yorker. I feel I am an American. We want to be there for you, to plead with you, not to act, not to say things when you are not calm. There are ways that we can go back to ourselves and practice so that we rediscover our calmness, our tranquility, our lucidity. There are ways by which we can look deeply to understand the real causes of the suffering. And that understanding will help us to do what needs to be done and not to do what could be harmful to us and to other people. Let us practice mindful breathing for half a minute before we continue. In Buddhist psychology, we used to speak of consciousness in terms of seed. We have the seed of anger in our consciousness. We have the seed of despair, of fear. But we also have the seed of understanding, wisdom, compassion, and forgiveness. If we know how to water the seed of wisdom and compassion in us, that seed, these seeds will manifest themselves as a powerful source of energy, helping us to perform an act of forgiveness and compassion that will be able to bring relief right away to our nation and to the world. That is my conviction. I believe very strongly that the American people have a lot of wisdom and compassion within themselves. I want you to be your best when you begin to act for the sake of America and for the sake of the world. With calmness, with lucidity, with understanding and compassion, you could turn to people who have cause a lot of damage and suffering to you and ask them a direct question.
You are listening to Thich Nhat Hanh, the Buddhist peace activist and Vietnamese monk. He was speaking last night at Riverside Church in Manhattan. We're going to go back to his speech and also play the second half of it tomorrow as we broadcast from Chinatown and on Manhattan Neighborhood Network, Channel 34, for this two-hour War and Peace special. Also broadcasting on Free Speech TV on the Dish Network, Channel 94.15. You are listening to Democracy Now in Exile. We'll be back with Thich Nhat Hanh in a minute.
Ready, bang, 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 bang.
Turkish musician Arto Tunoboyasyan, who was playing in the Nave just before Thich Nhat Hanh took the microphone and gave his address last night at Riverside Church. It was a free event, and thousands of people lined the streets to come and hear the Buddhist monk from Vietnam speak about peace and anger. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report, as we break the sound barrier with Thich Nhat Hanh.
We do not understand enough of your suffering. Could you tell us? We have not done anything to you. We have not tried to destroy you, to discriminate against you. And we do not understand why you have done that to us. There must be a lot of suffering within yourself. We want to listen to you. We might be able to help you. And together we can help build peace in the world. And if you are solid, if you are compassionate, when you make this statement, that question, and then they will tell you about their suffering. In Buddhism, we speak of the practice of deep listening, compassionate listening, a wonderful method by which we can restore communication. Communication between partners, communication between father and son, communication between mother and daughter, communication between nations. The practice of deep listening should be taken up by parents, by partners, so that they could understand deeply the suffering of the other person. That person might be our wife, our husband, our son, and our daughter. We may have enough goodwill to listen, but many of us have lost our capacity of listening, because we do have a lot of anger and violence in us. The other people do not know how to use kind speech. They always blame and judge. And the language is very often sour, bitter. And that kind of speech will always touch off the irritation and the anger in us, and prevent us to continue to listen deeply and with compassion. That is why goodwill to listen is not enough. We should need some training in order to be able to listen deeply and with compassion. I have the conviction that a father, if he knows how to listen to his son deeply with compassion, he will open the door of the heart of his son and restore communication. People in our Congress, in our Senate, should also train themselves in the art of deep listening and compassionate listening, there is a lot of suffering within the country also. And many people feel that the suffering is not understood. And that is why, as politicians, members of the parliament, members of the Congress have to train themselves in the art of deep listening. Listening to their own people, listening to the suffering within the country, because there is injustice in the country, there is discrimination in the country, there is a lot of anger in the country. And if we can listen to each other, we can also listen to the people outside of the country. Many of them are in a situation of despair. Many suffer because of injustice and discrimination. The amount of violence and despair in them is very huge. And if we know how to listen as a nation through their suffering, we can already bring a lot of relief. They feel that they are being understood. They can defuse the bomb already. I always advise to couples that when they get angry at each other, they should go back to their breathing, their mindful walking, embrace their anger, and look deeply into the nature of their anger. And they may be able to transform that anger in just 15 minutes or a few hours. And if they cannot do that, and then they will have to tell the other person that they suffer, they are angry, and they want the other person to know it. They will try to say it in a calm way. "Darling, I suffer, and I want you to know it." And in Plum Village, where I live and practice, we advise our friends not to keep your anger more than 24 hours without telling the other person. "Darling, I suffer. I want you to know it. I do not know why you have done such a thing to me. I do not know why you have said such a thing to me." And that the first thing he or she should tell the other person. And if they are not calm enough to tell it, they can write it down on a piece of paper. The second thing they can say or write down is this: "I am doing my best." It means I am practicing not to say anything, not to do anything in anger, because I know that doing so I will create more suffering. So I am embracing my anger, I am looking deeply into the nature of my anger. You tell the other person that you are practicing holding your anger and understanding your anger, in order to find out whether that anger has come from your own misunderstanding, wrong perception, your lack of mindfulness, your lack of skillfulness. And the third thing you might like to say to him or to her is that, "I need your help." Usually when we get angry at someone, we want to do the opposite. We want to say, "I don't need you. I can survive by myself alone. I need your help." It means I need your practice. I need your looking deeply. I need you to help me overcome this anger, because I suffer. And if I suffer, there's no way that you can be happy, because the happiness is not an individual matter. If the other person suffers, there's no way that you can be truly happy at all. So helping the other person to suffer less to smile, and then you will be happy also. The Buddha said, this is like this because that is like that. This is because that is.
You're listening to Vietnamese Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh.
Is the true language, the language of true love. It will inspire the other person to practice, to look deeply, and together you bring about understanding and reconciliation. I propose to my friends to write down these three sentences on a piece of paper and slip it into their wallet. And every time they get angry at their partner or their son or their daughter, they practice mindful breathing, they take it out and they read. It will be a bell of mindfulness, telling them not what to do and what not to do. And I believe that in an international conflict, the same kind of practice is possible also. That is why I propose to America as a nation to do the same. You tell the people you believe to be the cause of your suffering, that you suffer, that you want them to know it, that you want to know why they have done such a thing to you. And you practice listen deeply with compassion. And the quality of our being is very important, because that statement, that question is not a condemnation. But a willingness to create true communication. You are ready to listen to you. We know you must have suffered a lot in order to have done such a thing to us. You may have thought that we are the cause of your suffering. So please tell us that whether we have try to destroy you, whether we have tried to discriminate against you, so that we can understand. And we know that when we understand your suffering, we may be able to help you. That is what we call in Buddhism loving speech, kind language, that has the purpose of creating communication, restoring communication. And with communication restored, peace will be possible. This summer, a group of Palestinians came to Plum Village and practiced, together with a group of Israelis, a few dozens of them. We sponsor the coming and practicing together. In 2 weeks, they learn to sit together, walk mindfully together, enjoy the silent meal together, and sit quietly to listen to each other. And the practice taken up was very successful. At the end of the 2 weeks practice, they gave us a wonderful, wonderful report. One young lady said, "Thầy, this is the first time in my life that I see that peace in the Middle East is possible." Another young person said, "Thầy, when I first arrived in Plum Village, I did not believe that Plum Village is something real. But because in the situation of my country, you live in constant fear. and anger. When your children get into the bus, you are not sure that they can come home. When you go to the market, you are not sure that you could survive going home to your family. And that's why when it comes to Plum Village, you see people looking at each other with loving kindness, talking with each other kindly, walk peacefully, and doing everything mindfully. We did not believe that it is possible. It did not look real to me. But in the peaceful setting of Plum Village, they were able to be together, to live together, and to listen to each other. And finally, understanding came. They promised to us that when they went back to the Middle East, they would continue the practice. They will organize a day of practice every week on the local level, and a day of practice of mindfulness on a national level. And they plan to come to Plum Village as a bigger group to continue the practice. I think that if nations like America can organize that kind of setting where people can come together and spend their time practicing peace, and then they will be able to calm down their feelings, their fears, and then peace negotiation will be much easier.
Thich Nhat Hanh, Vietnamese Buddhist monk, speaking last night at Riverside Church in Manhattan, an evening of peace, embracing anger. Part two of this address we'll play tomorrow on Democracy Now! in Exile. And that does it for today's program. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland's at WBIX.org, where you can hear Democracy Now! As well as at webactive.com. Special thanks to Chase Pearson, Tony Riddle, Rick Youngers, Hoi No, Karen Renucci, Didi Halleck, Tom Poole, Lenny Charles, John Alpert, and Keiko Suno of Downtown Community Television, where we're based. And thank you to Sam Delgado and Charles Crizell. Pacifica Stations, KPFA, and affiliate KFCF in Fresno, as well as all the affiliates, we are Pacifica. You can see Democracy Now! in Exile on Channel 34 at Manhattan Neighborhood Network, and tomorrow on Channel 56, as well as Friday, as well as Free Speech TV, Channel 9415 on Dish TV. We are in the historic firehouse of Engine 31 in Chinatown, in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the band and the fired, from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.